Hi, I'm Mitsuki with the Brown Political Review's Multimedia Board. Welcome to our fourth episode of Beyond the Article, which is a series where we interview writers on their inspiration for and content of their articles. I'm here today with Bryce Vist. Hi, Bryce.
Hi.
And Bryce is concentrating in economics and IAPA, and he's the editor-in-chief for BPR.
Well, one of them anyway.
Okay, one of them. Bryce recently wrote an article on the state of the Russian opposition titled, Everybody Wants to Rule the Motherland. It's featured in the competition edition of the Brown Political Review magazine. So your one-sentence synopsis for this article is, the Russian opposition seems no closer to uniting after the death of Alexei Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
Could you maybe give a brief summary of your article and argument, just for anyone who maybe hasn't gotten a chance to read it yet?
Yeah, absolutely. So after Alexei Navalny died in a Siberian prison, a lot of called a gulag, actually, there was a great outpouring of grief, both within Russia and in the international community. And I noticed that a lot of our Western media outlets have, I mean, called him over the years, but especially after his death, referred to him as the leader of the Russian opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew anecdotally that while that might be true in some general sense, because he was the most public-facing figure of the opposition, in actual fact, that this is an opposition that's been really riven and divided by various sort of factional disputes for really over a decade at this point. So I wanted to investigate a little more thoroughly as to just how bad is that factionalism, and is there any real opportunity for everyone to coalesce after the death of this so-called leader of the opposition? And what I seem to show in my article is that no, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very factionalist opposition during Navalny's time. Navalny didn't really contribute to making it a less factional opposition, and after his death, there really aren't any signs that that's going to get any better.
Okay. I'd love to hear a little bit more about some detail into your writing process.
Mm-hmm.
How did that look for you?
Well, I realized very quickly that I wanted to pitch this article,
mm-hmm.
so even when I was doing a pitch, I had to do some preliminary research just to make sure that I wasn't going to lie and say, oh, this is a factional, you know, dispute, and actually there aren't any factional disputes. But once I got selected to write for the magazine, it was a lot of research. It was a lot of trying to actually nail down, you know, what are these most important factions and trying to get some good polling data as to what do opposition supporting Russians actually want to see in their leaders and who the current, like, leaders of the factions are and why they're the leaders and so on and so forth. And then from there, I made a lot of research both in English and in Russian. On the Russian side, actually, we're trying to nail down some of the statements that these people have made and isolating their disputes. And then on the English side, what has our media been saying and maybe some sources that would be more accessible to the average reader. In terms of actually writing it, I'm very much a sit-down-and-grind-it-out person. I know there are a lot of people who, you know, will write 200 words in an hour and come back to it the next day and write 400 more, and then the next day 600 more. I've never been able to operate that way. For me, it's just sit down 6-7 hours, whatever it is, and just grind out a draft.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of pitching the article,
mm-hmm.
so as a non-staff writer, there's a lot of opportunities to pitch articles to the U.S. World special feature sections of
mm-hmm.
every BPR magazine issue. So for anyone who might be interested in writing for BPR, could you maybe explain what the process is like for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are a Brown or RISD student, we publish a magazine twice a semester, so that means that twice a semester there's an opportunity to pitch to our magazine. And again, as you've said, that's to a world section, to the United States section, or to the special feature section. The special feature changes every issue. So we have competition now, before then was excess. In the past, we've had special features like scars, corruption, games, shadows. So just these sort of very general concepts that nonetheless you can make something political out of, ultimately. I mean, we publish our deadlines, of course, within the semester. At that
mm-hmm.
point, you submit a pitch, not especially long, 300 words perhaps, maybe with a 40 to 50 word thesis at the end. Those pitches are discussed by our panel of editors. And ultimately, if, you know, everyone in the room really likes a pitch, we'll contact you and, you know, get into the process of writing a political article. And then, obviously, it'll be beautifully illustrated by our creative team. Hopefully, you've seen our magazines around. They're extremely beautifully illustrated, and creative does an excellent job. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity to sort of get published in a fairly large magazine, at least by student standards, and, you know, just have something to share with family, friends, employers, whoever else it might be.
Yeah. I know you had a word limit for this particular article,
mm-hmm.
specifically because it is featured in the mag, so
mm-hmm.
I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into the issue. I think the one of the core problems that you identify is the main Russian opposition leaders, like the Navalny Party, then there's Katz, and then like mm-hmm. Garry Kasparov and co.
Yeah.
And they're unwilling to unite over their differences mm-hmm. and then conjoin forces to lead the charge against Putin.
Right.
So is the Russian public also equally split and stubborn in their willingness to set aside differences over petty issues, or would people be more willing to unite if the leaders could send a unified message?
So it's a very good question, and it's an mm-hmm. open question. And one of the things that I do try to emphasize at the end of my article is that really aside from all this factionalism, which from what I could tell, I mean, some of it is actually disputes over strategy, mm-hmm. but some of it is also just like absolutely petty, childish quarreling between people who don't like each other very much. But the bigger problem for the opposition as a whole is that it's really not that popular. I mean, I found a poll that I thought was really, really remarkable where a broad cross-section of the Russian public was asked by one of the few remaining reputable independent pollsters whether they would prefer... I think the wording was like an honorable candidate who shares their views
mm-hmm.
or Putin. And this is the craziest kind of push-pull, right? I mean, right. literally, the candidate of your dreams or Putin. And that question ended up split 50-50.
Really?
So, I mean, when you're operating in an environment where you've got half of the electorate basically selecting Putin over, like, pick the ideal person, you already have a hill to climb, right? And the argument I'm trying to make is that hill is tough to climb at the best of times. But if you're also having these stupid childish disputes, it's just absolutely not going to happen. So at the end of the day, I do make an argument for unity, to the extent that unity is going to be able to be achieved, to uniting on the largest common platform that all these people can basically co-sign, which is probably a very generic, just anti-corruption type platform.
Mm-hmm.
And deferring the really serious issues, like, for example, what to do with the Ukraine war, to after getting rid of Putin. But at the same time, and admittedly, my article is very pessimistic because I don't see this happening. I mean, I think it's very doubtful.
Yeah, and you also mentioned in your article that, like, Western media tends to paint Navalny as the unquestioned leader of the mm-hmm. Russian opposition. I definitely believe this because, to be honest, I hadn't really heard of any other, like, factions of the Russian opposition
mm-hmm.
and, like, for example, only heard of Kasparov in the context of chess.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think this idolization exists to begin with? Like, what role do you see the Western media also playing in the future of the Russian opposition?
It's a great question. I mean, I think Navalny, I mean, for a start, he's been around on the stage for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he nearly won the Moscow mayorship in 2013. This was, like, a big coup. Because, you know, an opposition figure very nearly gets to this, like, important summit of power. And then after that, it was to some extent a matter of his personal heroism. I mean, we have these repeated poisoning attempts, and nonetheless, he comes back and back again into Russia, knowing he's going to be poisoned again or imprisoned again or beaten up again or whatever else it might be. And I think that resonated with a lot of people, that this person's willing to undergo these personal sacrifices for his country. So I think that was a good deal of it as well. Beyond that, I mean, his anti-corruption foundation, which the Russian acronym is FBK, put together a number of really, really embarrassing exposés on the Putin regime's corruption, on the way in which these oligarchs live, on this secret palace that Putin constructed pretty much with state funds. And all this was really deeply embarrassing. And obviously that put a target on his back, but it also made the Western media go, wow, there's this courageous person who's really exposing all these difficulties that are occurring in Russia at the moment. And with respect to these other opposition leaders, I mean, so Maxim Katz, who you've mentioned, I mean, this is a person who lives in Israel, whose presence is really exclusively on YouTube and who streams only in Russian.
Okay.
And realistically, it's going to be difficult for Western media, even insofar as they know of him, and I'm sure, for example, the New York Times does or the Washington Post does, to really feature this person as, like, a major figure, because obviously the question for mostly uninformed readers is going to be, who the hell is this guy and why am I hearing about him, right? Whereas Navalny, I mean, people can think about the poisonings, can think about the exposés, mm-hmm. can think about, you know, oh, this is a person who was nearly at political power, and that's someone that you can maybe read about. And it's really the same for Kasparov, who, as you say yourself, I mean, you know of him in the chess sense, not in the political sense, and that makes sense, because politically, though within Russia he is an important opposition figure, he hasn't really made a name for himself as an opposition figure in the West, so I think it's natural that the media is not really reporting on him.
Yeah, so post Navalny, where do you see Western media in terms of how they report on Russian opposition?
It's a great question. So after Navalny's death, his widow, Yulia Navalnaya, mm-hmm. has sort of tried to take up her husband's mantle a little
right.
bit and sort of become the leader of the Russian opposition. And in some ways, I think, in my view, she's repeated some of the errors of the past. She's again picking these sort of what, in my view, are really petty quarrels, like another sort of oppositional line figure in Russia, Boris Nadezhdin, who ran as sort of an anti-war candidate and then was banned from the presidential election as a result of that. He posted on Twitter, well, X, formerly Twitter, I should say, after Navalny's death, that, you know, people can have different views about him, but we should acknowledge that he was, you know, an important figure in Russia. And she actually responded to him and said, oh, from people like you, like, we don't need to hear that, you know, you can have different views about Navalny. That sort of, you know, Navalny was a hero and you're whatever you are, so stop bad-mouthing him. And it's like, I mean, to me, this is really childish and petty and just not really something that's going to help construct a meaningful coalition. And I also understand that this was in a time of grief for her and that she can be forgiven for that type of personal outburst. But it's really not the sort of thing that's going to build any significant bridges going forward. But I mean, ultimately, it does remain to be seen whether these opposition figures are going to sort of give up on their dream of I'm going to rule rather than the opposition's going to rule. And that's, I think, what the title's trying to get at, right? Everybody wants to rule the motherland. One of the big complaints about Navalny from his co-oppositionists frequently in times of conflict was Navalny wants to be the person who freed Russia from Putin more than he wants to see Russia free from Putin. If that's a distinction that makes sense. And Khodorkovsky, who's one of the people in the Kasparov camp, was interviewed and mentioned something along the lines of, I'm scared of Navalny because I think he can become another Putin if he enters power. And it's like, I do worry that we're seeing this again, the same exact cycle. Everyone wants to rule the motherland rather than they want someone who's not Putin ruling the motherland.
So I'd also love to hear your thoughts on the possibilities of, like, the flip side, which would be responses from the Russian government. So, like, Putin's party, if you will. Mm-hmm. If, hypothetically, and I know you said this was super unlikely, but the Russian opposition were to be able to unite and gain tons of ground that way, how do you see the government response?
Well, it's an interesting question in large part because, I mean, there have been these sort of isolated movements. I mean, throughout the 2010s, there were these actually pretty large anti-government protests, isolated ones, and largely restricted to large municipalities, but they did exist and they did happen. And ultimately, it's a combination of stuff. Some of it is just plain old repression, right? Everyone was protesting, okay, the cops come, you know, get in the car and you're getting sentenced to jail. Some people is just beating them up. Some stuff is assassination and murder of prominent leaders. Boris Nemtsov pretty famously was assassinated on the Kremlin Bridge by two assassins who actually didn't do a very good job covering up their ties to the Kremlin, and that was to an extent perceived as deliberate, sort of, you know, a warning, we're coming for you. So these are all, you know, all the exact same old tactics. And yet, nonetheless, I mean, it keeps happening. There was this weird fight a few years ago with the governor of one of the remote Siberian regions who just decided to stand up to Putin. And that was also a random flashpoint, just very briefly. So, I mean, it does keep happening that we do see these little heartbeats of internal resistance. Ultimately, the current Russian state has been very successful at eliminating all of those heartbeats, at least so far. In the future, perhaps if the opposition presents a united front, that'll get harder. Perhaps they can coordinate actions and so on. But, I mean, even, like, going back to the hypothetical of can the opposition unite, it's not even clear whether the opposition's interested in uniting on doing actions. One of the polls that I looked at for opposition members had one of the questions being, do you support the killing of pro-Ukraine war propagandists? Like, people who get on TV and say, like, Ukrainians are subhumans and, like, we need to eliminate them for the good of our society. And it's like, there's a 30 yes, 70 no split on that question. Like, is it morally justified to kill them? And it's like, how are you just going to build around that disagreement? Like, like this is something fundamental enough where it's like, where are we going to find common ground with a thing like this? So when you have this really factionalized opposition, it is really difficult. And even on issues more basic than that, like, for example, with the Ukraine war, like, suppose the opposition gets into power. Should we stop this thing entirely? Or are we honor-bound to prosecute this war sort of to the end the best we can, despite the fact that we shouldn't have gotten into it in the first place? And then there's the antecedent question, which is, well, how about the Crimean Peninsula, which we grabbed in 2014? Should we give that back, or is that ours now? And there's not a consensus on any of this. And I mean, in part, that is why I'm making the argument that all of this has to be deferred to after. Just forget about it, kick the can down the road, get Putin out of the way, then we can talk. And I recognize there's a really big counterargument that says, well, if you don't get any clarity on any of these questions, no one's going to be interested in your movement. And I do see that, but at the same time, taking a strong stance on any of this might cut off enough of the populace to actually make taking power impossible.
Yeah, I never realized how complex the dynamics in the Russian opposition were, and you did an incredible job of presenting your argument.
Thank you.
Is there maybe anything else that you wanted to include that you couldn't because of the word limit?
Well, I mean, I was given a soft limit of 1,300 and a hard limit of 1,400. And at first, I was actually really nervous about that because I was worried that I couldn't fill the space. I was like, oh my, I'm going to have to create nuance where there isn't any. Because I'll be honest, when I began researching, I myself didn't know about these currents. And then as I actually began researching, I was like, oh no, hold on. Now I have the words to really demonstrate carefully all of these little nuances and show that, you know, that these are very deep running cracks. But I think the work on actually ended up being perfect. I think I ended up in the 1350 to 1400 range, so sort of just, you know, using my space to the full. And I mean, there wasn't anything where it's like, oh, dang it, you know, I wish I would have included that, but, you know, I've been shot by the word count.
Yeah, so if you've made it to the end of this episode, don't forget to check out Bryce's article in the competition issue of the BPR magazine. It's a great read, super relevant in the context of today's world, and again, it's titled, Everybody Wants to Rule the Motherland. Please consider following BPR podcasts wherever you get them, and please, please subscribe to the magazine for more amazing articles like Bryce's. Thank you, Bryce, for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for tuning in.